This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. On today's roundtable, the Pope tries again to make amends with the Muslim community, and New Orleans reopens its Superdome with fanfare. Joining us today from our New York bureau is Michael Myers, executive director for the New York Civil Rights Coalition. Laura Washington, Chicago Sun-Times columnist, is in our Chicago bureau. And from NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C., Yvonne Bino is author of the book Stand and Deliver, Political Activism, Leadership, and Hip-Hop Culture. Thank you all for joining us, and let's go straight to the Superdome. It's been more than a year, but football came back last night to the Superdome in New Orleans. There was lots of hoopla, including performances by musicians like Green Day and U2, who paid tribute to the city's musical heritage in their own ways. All right, so there you have U2, which happens personally to be one of my favorite concert bands, playing a tribute to Fats Domino, Aaron Neville, other New Orleans musicians who weren't playing. What's up with that, Yvonne? Like, why weren't they? I mean, you know, New Orleans has more musicians per capita than probably any city in the world. So why did they have to import people? I mean, it's no disrespect to U2, but it's just like, that's kind of weird.
Yeah, actually, it's kind of weird, and I think it speaks to the whole half-and-half situation of this kind of celebration. Certainly, you want to bring attention to New Orleans. You want to celebrate the fact that you can get thousands of people there, and at least for that weekend, help with the economy. But it's a short-lived situation. Until they can get some sustained improvement to the infrastructure, having a football game, you know, once or twice a month is not going to be enough to cut it. So I think it kind of speaks, you two, as wonderful as they are, I would be agreement that there were plenty of people who could have foot the bill, rather been on the bill. But I wonder whether the incentive was to have to cater to the people who they thought were going to be in the Superdome, as opposed to the people who actually are still living in New Orleans or were part of the original New Orleans structure. And I think that's what's the question on the table. What is New Orleans going to look like? Is it going to look like what it was in the past with the jazz and the French Quarter and such? Or is it going to become a new entity which, you know, may or may not resemble its past glory?
Michael and Laura, before I get to you, I just have another little bit of tape to play. This is something that a commentator for Monday Night Football had to say, just sort of bubbling over with enthusiasm.
What a pleasure it is to welcome all of you back inside the Louisiana Superdome. Hi, I'm Mike Tirico. Welcome to Monday Night Football. The last time the thousands gathered here, their mission was survival. Well, 56 weeks after Hurricane Katrina, everything's changed about New Orleans, but as thousands gather...
Everything's changed about New Orleans. Has it, Michael?
Well, Farai, you too can be a believer in eclectic music, but I think the question is not what New Orleans is going to look like, but what does New Orleans look like right now? I think it's a city that has always been poor. It's a city that has always had the poor in the background. Even when people went to the French Quarter, you had the poor shining shoes and dancing in the French Quarter. That's a sort of eclectic taste in music. But, you know, you have to rebuild New Orleans. You got to start someplace. So with insurance money, with bond dollars, with FEMA money, they renovated the Superdome and reopened it. I think that's okay, because you need economic revival, you need cultural revival, you need New Orleans to be again an attraction for tourists and as an entertainment capital of the South, and hopefully you'll bring people back and do something for the people in terms of a new town approach, so that you have new housing, economically and racially integrated housing, built high. But until then, New Orleanians will not be singing with the crowd when the Saints come marching in.
Laura, you know, there's a bunch of new proposals on the table. First of all, there's a set of proposals to really revamp the Ninth Ward, which has been you know, in some ways slated for destruction in the past. It's like, we're going to turn it into an industrial zone. We're going to turn it into a green zone. We're not going to make it a neighborhood. Now it seems that officials are turning around and saying, we're going to make this a neighborhood. But does a celebration like last night, and, you know, personally, I was on the phone with a friend who lives in New Orleans, and she was actually very excited about the Superdome reopening as a sports palace. But kind of where are our priorities on this?
Well, I think that the question of priorities is key here. First of all, last night's event was a global story. I'm sure that game was seen in some ways all the way around the world, and it was a very important symbol. But I think some people are troubled by the symbol of the reopening of the Superdome. I think it cost something like $185 million to reopen, and people wonder about if that money isn't being misplaced, and if that kind of a spectacle doesn't, again, tell the story of the better half, quote unquote, of New Orleans, the wealthy half, the tourism half, the half that was least damaged and has come back quickly. And of course, as Michael pointed out, we do need to have economic development. But I'm afraid that the stories of the folks who are still out there in the areas that really have remained untouched. I was there in June, and I know some rest of us have been down there too. They don't even do tours, your typical tours anymore in New Orleans, you know, taking you to the French Quarter, taking you to historical sites. They do what they call a devastation tour, because there are places that just are unbelievable in terms of the devastation, and we haven't really yet addressed that.
But the Superdome is not going to be turned into a museum, and it's not going to be turned into a mausoleum. So you have to do something with it. You have to renovate it, and you have to reopen it. So, you know, again, as I understand it, it was reopened based mostly on insurance money and bond money, and that could not be used for any other purpose.
Well, you had to renovate the Ninth Ward, too, Michael, and you had to renovate a lot of other areas, not just in New Orleans, but around New Orleans as well. And I think people wonder where the real priorities are.
And that's the whole point, that you had a wonderful weekend per se, but the people who want to come back, who are in Houston, Atlanta, and so forth, that's not going to help them provide them with affordable housing. That's not going to open up these small mom-and-pop businesses who have now closed. So, again, it was great if you had the hundreds of dollars to buy a ticket, or you already had a season ticket to come in there and you know, regale in the Superdome. But for the average person who was a New Orleans citizen, this probably did very little for to improve their day-to-day existence or to help them have the means to come back.
I want to move on to another topic.
Yes.
Actor and philanthropist, and some would say cranky man, Bill Cosby, is urging every American to contribute $8 to help build a national slavery museum. I know I'm going to get in trouble for that. In the battlefields of the Civil War in Virginia, Cosby has committed $1 million of his own money. He's also been very generous, you know, to places like Spelman. The project will cost about $200 million. Now, there is a King Memorial going up on the Mall in Washington, which is a big deal, and there's tons of, you know, millions of dollars being raised for that. There's
African-American Museum.
Yeah, there's the African-American Museum. There's mm-hmm. the Museum of the African Diaspora in the Bay Area. Bill Cosby, some folks argue, could have said, everybody give $8 to Katrina victims. Everybody give $8 mm-hmm. to education. What do you make of him? You know, first of all, he's on his moral crusade, but then specifically pushing this project. Is there any significance to this, Michael?
I have no patience for Bill Cosby's brand of negritude. I really don't. And I don't want him lecturing me about how to spend my dollars. He has lots of dollars, much more dollars than I have. So if it's only going to be $200 million, then he should, you know, round up 199 more millionaires to match his $1 million, and then they have the $200 million. But it's going to cost more than that to operate it. I don't know why we need a National Slavery Museum. But if we need it, those who think we need it, they should pay for it. Don't look to my pockets. Don't look for my dollars, because there are a lot of demands on my dollars, and a National Slavery Museum is very low, if at all, on my list of priorities.
Laura, you know, I reeled off a list of different projects that are commemorating the African-American experience. It seems like in some ways we are in a growth phase for museums, monuments. Regardless of whether Bill Cosby is championing one that you particularly like, do you see any kind of significance to all of these new projects happening at once?
Well, I think the significance is obviously there's been a growth of black wealth in this country. Cosby is just one symbol of the number, the Oprahs and the Michael Jordans and the number of folks out there that can spearhead these kinds of causes. And I think that's a good thing. That says a lot about the progress we have made. I think, you know, Michael's response to the slavery museum as being not a priority for him, I think is a typical response that you're going to hear from a lot of folks, and not just the Michael types, but you're going to hear from whites, you're going to hear from blacks from a range of perspectives, because a lot of people want to forget about slavery. They want to put it behind us. They want to move on. And if we're going to talk about it, let's talk about reparations. I think that's the perspective that you're going to hear out there. The other issue is, you know, we have to remember we are a very generous country. You know, Cosby says, you know, he thinks this is going to be a tough one. Well, it wasn't a tough one you saw a lot of outpouring in terms of aid for 9/11. You saw the outpouring in terms of aid for Katrina, in terms of tsunami. Regular folks are willing to dig into their pockets and help folks in need. But again, as you said, I'd like to see that $8 per person go to those folks that are trying to get back to New Orleans from places around the country who don't even have the car fare to get back.
Yvonne, is there any kind of generational spin on this? Because a lot of these new monuments and memorials and museums are reaching back in time, which is very important. Is that something that's going to help connect, say, the hip-hop generation to the civil rights generation, or is it something that younger people are just going to tune out of?
I don't think it's going to have any significant impact on bridging the generational divide. I think that we are looking at a lot of different projects. It's not projects. It was the Reginald Lewis Museum that is now in Baltimore. Reginald Lewis himself left, I believe, $5 million, and that project cost $48 million or thereabouts to put into place. I think, as you mentioned earlier, is the Martin Luther King monument or museum on the mall. They've been trying to raise money for that forever, and now here's another one. I think for me personally, this is less about whether or not this is a priority in my own life, and it's more of fact, where are the people with money? If we feel that these are priorities, if the Bill Cosbys and the so forth, all these other people want to have these things, then I think they need to ante up and stop, and to a certain degree, not necessarily look to the rest of us to put these things into place. Baltimore was very instrumental with the Reginald Lewis Museum. I think that the places and the cities that want to participate and help to finance these things, as well as the people who want to finance them, I think that's what we need to be looking at. But rather than some entity, Lone Ranger in kind of mode, saying we need to do this, and then they don't have the money or the resources to raise the funds, I think it's kind of outlandish. So I think certainly we need to look at the past. We need to examine it. I'm not opposed to even having something that talks about slavery, but it needs to be in a 21st century context too, not just to bring in the Bill Cosby era, but it does have to bring into a new era of people so they can have a greater understanding. Museum going is, you know, not at its height. I mean, cultural entities in general are not doing well.
Just so wait till we get old and we get our hip-hop museum.
Well,
by that time, people will say we're totally irrelevant, but I want to move on.
You will pay for it.
and that's the point. That everybody who's championing these things should be ready to write a check for them as well.
All right, but we got to move on. One more speed round topic. Okay. Back to the Pope and the Muslim community. Pope Benedict XVI addressed Muslim diplomats yesterday, maintaining that our future depends on good relations between followers of both faiths.
Yes.
One Italian Muslim representative, Khalil Altobat, told reporters he felt the Pope was sincere.
He is working to resolve the problems between Vatican and Muslims in this moment.
So you've got one Muslim leader saying, all right, the Pope is doing the right thing. My question, and we got to proceed fairly quickly, is it too late for the people who may not be moderate Muslims, but the people who may be more extremist and will probably stay pissed off?
The people who are more extremists are not going to accept any apology. I don't understand why the apology was offered. If no offense was intended and no offense was in the statement, why apologize? For me, the issue is free speech, freedom of religion, separation of church and state. The Pope should have said something about the situation in Indonesia where three Catholics were executed. He should have said something about Saudi Arabia where, I understand, Christians cannot even practice their faith. Why shouldn't the Pope be able to speak about these issues? That's what his job is.
But Michael, the issue is that he's singling out this particular faith and implying that it is founded or is steeped in violence. And he hasn't spoken out on a lot of other issues like this, as you point out. Another one of the representatives who was there from the Muslim community had a different opinion. He said he felt that the conversation was not a dialogue, but a monologue. Basically, the Pope brought them all together, gave them a little speech, shook hands, and left. And so I think there's a deep level still of dissatisfaction that he still really doesn't get it. He's going to Turkey in a couple months, and it'll be interesting to see, since Turkey was one of the most violently opposed to his comments. It'll be interesting to see how he's received there.
I don't think the Pope will ever get an alternative religion.
Well, also, too, I think the broader question really has to do with the concept of free speech. Certainly people, bash Christianity, and the Christians who want to support that, you know, they have a dialogue back and forth, sometimes rancorous, sometimes more civil.
Absolutely.
But I think with Islam, the extremists, I don't think there's anything that you're going to have a dialogue on. I think if you make any criticism, even however slight, they're going to be up in arms, and we've seen that happening. So whether or not the Pope should have apologized, I think it's kind of beside the point. I think for these extremist elements of Islam, is that you can say nothing that they decide or perceive as to be a critical. And I think that's the biggest issue on the table in terms of a world dialogue and different religions and cultures being able to work with each other.
All right, we're gonna have to leave it there. I'm sorry. So we've been talking in Washington, D.C. to Yvonne Bino, author of the book Stand and Deliver, Political Activism, Leadership, and Hip-Hop Culture. Laura Washington, Chicago Sun-Times columnist, is in Chicago. And in New York, Michael Myers, executive director of the New York Civil Rights Coalition. Thank you all for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Farai.